Media recognition from Bloomberg, Reuters, Recycling Trade Publications. Patented process for 100% recovery of critical metals, including cobalt, lithium, nickel, manganese, aluminum. American Manganese is focused on recycling lithium-ion batteries for electric vehicles. American Manganese trades on the TSX Venture, AMY, the U.S., AMYZF, and Frankfurt 2AM. For more information, visit AmericanManganeseInc.com or phone me, Larry Ray, at 778-574-4444.
You're listening to HowStreet.com Radio, available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. Welcome to HowStreet.com Radio, the online source for market opinions. Here is Jim Goddard.
My guest is Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. He's also a portfolio manager and financial advisor in Edmonton. His website, MacbethMacLeodPartners.com. You can find him on Twitter at HMACBE, HMACB. Hilliard, welcome back to the show.
It's great to be with you again.
Hilliard, of course, people are talking about inflation and interest rates on the rise. And, of course, that affects the housing market, the entire economy. Well, let's talk housing first. Canadians complaining that housing's unaffordable, there's too much speculation. And now high interest rates, mortgage rates, are going to make it even more unaffordable. What's your take there?
Well, so the interest rate cycle has turned. Obviously, the big thing with housing for the last 20 years, really, was the ever lower trajectory to interest rates. So everybody could afford a house. And then when they couldn't afford it anymore, the rates would go lower, and then they could afford it again. So every time it got up against it, hit the wall, the factors, and I wouldn't say it was a deliberate policy, but it might have been a little bit deliberate, was to lower interest rates to create affordability. And I'm saying that in air quotes because it really isn't. I mean, the house price goes up; it's not really. It doesn't really make it affordable. It's just the interest, the monthly payment that becomes affordable, and that now has changed. So, one of the things that you and I talked about briefly before, but it's worth revisiting, is the fact that when interest rates rise, mortgage rates will rise, and the consumer price index, when it measures housing, it measures it very imperfectly. But one of the reasons it's been very flawed is that the interest rate is one of the key components. So as the interest rate dropped, the CPI thought the cost of housing was dropping, even when house prices were going up at 7% a year for the last 20 years. So when interest rates rise, the irony is going to be that the CPI will think the shelter cost is going up, and of course it will be, but house prices might be coming down. They might be coming down quite rapidly and quite a bit, but you'll see that the CPI continues to reflect a higher cost of shelter. They call it shelter in the CPI. And so that'll be the puzzling thing. And I suspect that many people in the government, in the Bank of Canada aren't aware of this little kind of little wrinkle. It's buried deep inside the calculation of the CPI, and I wasn't aware of it till I did the research. And so we'll see. But as the interest rates rise, people are going to be surprised at how many potential new buyers get knocked out of the game, and unless the government keeps changing the rules so that people can qualify. You know, they've got it now to where you're allowed to spend 40 or 50% of your income on buying a house. I guess they could make that 60 or 70% or 80%. They could change the rules however they want, but I suspect they won't do that this time. So, if those new buyers coming into the market aren't able to get the loan anymore, then that'll be a big negative for the housing market. And, we've already seen a little bit of a dip in the housing market, sort of similar to 2017 when house prices in Toronto went down about 10 to 15%. We're kind of getting pretty close to that in some parts of Toronto right now.
Now, when the stress test for qualifying for a mortgage came out, a lot of people were criticizing it, saying interest rates haven't gone up in 20 years. They keep going down. There's no need for it. Does it look like, in hindsight now, the stress test was the right thing to do?
Well, the stress test needed to be tougher, and it wasn't tough enough. You know, there were so many ways, loopholes, and ways to get around it that the lenders managed to get a whole bunch of people into housing at peak prices that really couldn't afford it. You know, I learned how it works in Germany, and of course Germany hasn't had a housing bubble at all for the last 40 years probably. But this, you sit down with the lender, there's no government involvement. You sit down with the lender, and the lender is entering into a 20 or 30 or 40 year agreement with you to buy a house. So they want to know if you have a 30 or 40% down payment, first of all. Secondly, they want to know, what your income is and what the prospects are for your future job. And thirdly, they want to know, they want to see your bank statements to see if you've been able to save money every month. So they, because their assumption is if you can't save money as a non-homeowner, what chance do you have as a homeowner of saving money? So it's a completely backwards thing. You know, people in Canada that can't save money as renters buy a house because then they say, well, if I buy a house, then I'll be forced to save money. So in Germany, you have to demonstrate that you're able to save money on your monthly, income versus your monthly expenses before you're allowed to buy a house. And that's not the government saying that. That's the lender saying that. I don't think we'll go to that extreme. That's fairly extreme, but it has worked in Germany to the extent that they haven't had these ridiculous bubbles like we have in Canada, and Australia is the other place where it's really quite outlandish.
Well, banks in Canada, it seems, will find ways for you to buy a house. They really want to supply that mortgage. Are mortgages tightening up at all, or are they still trying to do their best to shovel mortgage money out the door?
I think in the COVID recession 2 years ago, there was a general agreement among the banks and the government. I don't have any direct knowledge of this, but just watching and reading between the lines, that they encouraged the banks to go out and be as generous as possible with the loans, and not just for buying housing, but also for businesses to survive through we'll help you get through this tough times kind of thing. They did a deferral of the mortgage. They would change the payments if you needed it. They did all that kind of stuff. I don't see that happening again. The main way that people got around the rules was to have a minimum 20% down payment. And the way that people got the 20% down payment was supposed to be, one of the biggest sources was the bank, was the bank of mom and dad. You know, they go to the mom and dad, say, we need, in Toronto it would be $1 million house. We need $200,000 down payment. Then we'll give an $800,000 mortgage. And, so, Mom and Dad didn't have $200,000 just sitting in a bank account. I mean, some of them did, but most of them didn't. But they could go to the bank and get a HELOC, and then they could use the HELOC because their house prices had gone up so much. If they were homeowners, they were able to borrow $200,000 on a HELOC and then give that as a gift to the kids. So you got two houses mortgages or HELOC'd. The borrowing is all against the real estate. And so that would be a factor, because the rules on HELOCs are a little bit stricter than mortgages. You can only borrow up to 65% of the value of a house versus 80 or 90% with a mortgage. So if the house price comes down, the ability of the mom and dad to HELOC and give the kids a down payment would be restrained. And then, of course, housing is such a big component. It's estimates are as high as 20 or 30% of the economy. If we go into a period where housing activity is dropping, it has a ripple through the whole of our economy, and that means that the young people that are applying for that $800,000 mortgage in this example might not have the incomes anymore. One of them might get laid off at work, for example. So, obviously, nobody can borrow $800,000 without two incomes, unless it's maybe it's a heart surgeon or something. If people lose their jobs or get reduced pay, and if the stress test and the various requirements for mortgage borrowing are enforced, there'll be a lot of people that get knocked out of the game. But the big thing is the interest rates. So even the tiny little interest rate increases we've had so far, where mortgages have gone, say, from average, say, 2.5% up to 3.5-4%, it makes a huge difference in the monthly payments. And a lot of people are up against it on the monthly payments already. So if mortgage rates go to 5 or 6%, which is quite likely in my opinion, although I'm not joined very many people in that belief. I think most people would say, oh no, I think the 5-year fixed rate now is about 4.4%. That it won't go much higher than that. they're basing that on the belief that if it goes any higher than that, it'll wreck the housing market completely. But in the past, when inflation has been 6, 7, 8, 9%, interest rates went even higher than the rate of inflation. I checked back to 1977 to 1983, and the numbers are quite shocking how high interest rates went back then.
Now, inflation is the big issue so many people are talking about. Prices for homes have gone up dramatically, food, gasoline, and so on. But will inflation continue this at this rate if interest rates and mortgage rates go up and people all of a sudden stop buying that extra property, either for recreation or speculation, or stop buying cars because the one they have works okay and they don't want to have to pay higher interest rates on a car loan?
So what happened in 1977 to 1983 was the last cycle that's comparable to this. Is interest rates had to go up a lot before people have changed their behavior. So it was basically, it's hard to believe this actually. When I was checking the numbers today because I still find it puzzling that this actually happened. But in 1978, the Canada savings bond rate was 9.5%. And by 1981, it was 19.5%. And in between those two points, inflation went up to 12-13%. It never got as high as 19%. I think it peaked out around 12 or 13%. There was two recessions. There was a recession in 1980, and then there was another recession in 1982. The recession in 1982 was much worse, and it was caused by the fact that interest rates were so high. You know, 18-20%, depending on what instrument you're talking about, and that finally broke the back of the inflationary rise, and inflation started to recede. It didn't recede right away. It took a while. It actually took years to get down to, 2 or 3% that we've been used to more recently. But it eventually did work. So the fact that the idea that, like yesterday, the Federal Reserve raised their interest rate to 1%. Oh my God, from the 50 basis point, from 0.5% to 1%. And then, so therefore the banks will base their rate off of that. Maybe the prime rate will go to 3 or 4%. The mortgage rate in the U.S. is up to 5%. The idea that those kind of numbers are going to choke off the housing market, choke off the consumer demand is pretty far-fetched. I think, I might be wrong on this, but I think it's going to take a lot more than that to get people to change their attitudes. Because initially what happens is people start thinking, well, I got to move more quickly. If rates are going up, I got to get in before I can still get a mortgage at 5%. 6 months from now, the mortgage will be 7%. So I better get in now. And, of course, all the people in the lending department of the lenders, the banks and everybody else are bonus based on activity. So they are also on the side of wanting to get everybody, into a mortgage and into a house. So it's, the system is set up so that it'll go on for a while before. So basically, the bottom line is the Federal Reserve and the Bank of Canada have to keep raising rates for as long as it takes until something breaks, and it'll be something big that breaks, and then that'll be the sign that maybe they've gone far enough to put a lid on this thing. But it might take longer than people expect.
We'll have more with Hilliard Macbeth right after this.
Don't miss out. Stay informed. Receive the HowStreet.com weekly recap with thought-provoking podcasts, radio, and articles delivered to your inbox. Sign up for the HowStreet.com weekly recap on our homepage at HowStreet.com.
Welcome back. We're chatting with Hilliard Macbeth. Hilliard, apart from higher interest rates, is there anything that local, provincial, or national governments can do about inflation when it's a worldwide phenomena?
It's amazing, the supply chain issues. I don't see how higher interest rates fix this. I don't see how higher interest rates in Canada fix the surging cost of energy in Europe because of the natural gas price going up so high. It's a worldwide phenomenon. And food, food is just incredibly expensive. The official inflation rate for food in Canada, believe it or not, is 7%. And That seems extremely low. I've seen numbers as high as 44% in other parts of the world in terms of the increase in the cost of food. And of course, the because Ukraine and Russia both supply a lot of wheat and other grains to the world markets, we'll see inflation in that area. Fertilizer costs, for example, have quadrupled in the last few months. And so that cost will go in. This is planting season now, and the farmer has to decide if he or she wants to put the cost of the fertilizer into the mix. You know, the diesel cost for the machinery has gone way up. The fertilizer cost has gone way up. But if the crop is good and if the grain prices are as high as they might be by September, maybe it's still a good deal to take that gamble. I don't know. I wouldn't want to be a farmer right now. But I think 7% increase in, which is the official CPI number, is way too low. I think the cost of food and energy is going up at double digits for sure. And eventually, and of course we know that housing has been going up much more rapidly than the official rate in the CPI. So, I think people are intuitively aware of that. I think people sense that the official number, by the way, in Canada, 6.7. They sense that the inflation rate is quite a bit higher than that. So they're making their decisions based on what their feeling is about inflation, not necessarily on the official numbers.
Right. And, Canada and the U.S. back in the 90s agreed that the CPI index, calculations would change. They would no longer include house prices and energy prices because they were too unstable, too volatile to use as a constant thing. But take away a person's home and the cost of bringing in food, getting food, growing food, getting the kids to school, and you take that out of the calculation, what are we supposed to do, live in a cave?
Maybe we will be living in a cave. You know, I checked back again. I mentioned that era from 1977, 1983. The peak was 17% on housing costs. The peak on rent was 9.9% annual increase. And of course, food was way up there, too. I don't remember the exact, but it was definitely way up in the 15-20% range. So the current numbers are way, way lower than that. And yet, this inflationary environment worldwide seems to be as big a deal, if not bigger, than what we had back in the late 70s. I don't know. It took a Federal Reserve chairman named Paul Volcker. Some people think he was a little bit crazy maybe to do this, but he kept raising rates until it stopped. And that took much longer than people thought. So that's the problem, you know, with central banks. They say that they have the tools to get inflation back under control, but really all they have is the one tool, which is the interest rate. And the interest rate is not necessarily going to fix, as you mentioned a minute ago, supply chain issues or war in Ukraine or any number of other issues out there. You know, raising interest rates in Canada doesn't do anything to that.
Yes, I heard the Fed chair say we can't do anything about supply. We can only try to do something about demand. Well, it's the supply part that usually causes inflation.
Yeah, I mean, the demand was certainly causing the availability of cheap credit was definitely causing the inflation for quite a long time, but the inflation was relatively muted. It was when the combination of a lot of money circulating in the economy, because it had been created by all these bank loans that were made and the government spending and that sort of thing. When that met up with a supply chain disruption, the combination of the two, especially for a country like Canada, where we don't make very much in Canada anymore. We basically buy everything from the world markets. So when that hits, and it hasn't, and I don't think it's finished yet, because certainly the lockdowns in Shanghai and Beijing and some of those places in China where they make a lot of the stuff that we buy, when those shortages hit, it's going to be really a difficult time to keep inflation under 10%. And I think once, if and when inflation were to hit 10%, it's not that far off in the U.S. It's at 8.5, right? So only a small amount to go to get to 10. Once inflation gets to 10 officially, then people's attitudes are going to change quite a bit. But it doesn't guarantee that it stops right away. You know, there's the take, You know, in 1974, Canada put wage and price controls in. So that was inflation. It still didn't stop inflation. Inflation didn't peak until 1981. Now I'm not saying that 7 years seems like a long time, in today's terms. I think it would happen much faster than that. And wage and price controls didn't work either. So, but I do know that right now, the construction costs in Toronto were going up so rapidly. And then all of the workers, or most of the workers, walked off the job on Monday of this week. There's about 30 union segments, and quite a few of them have settled on a wage increase, but there's about five or six of them that haven't settled. But if it's the framers or whoever it is, if they walk off the job, it doesn't matter that the other 26 of the categories are still willing to work. All of the high-rise construction jobs, and there's over 200 cranes active in Toronto right now, are idle because you can't have some key components of them not appearing to work. So those wage increases, when they finally are agreed, will just put more inflation into the system.
Yes, it's interesting too. Do you see any solutions to affordable housing, affordable rent? Some people have claimed it's slow permit issuing by municipalities that have caused it, but a lot of cities have actually prided themselves on how fast they can turn that permit around, and they say that's not the problem. What is the problem, and are there any simple solutions? And I bet the answer is no.
It's, you know, you got to do something about speculative. Well, there's two things. There's speculative demand, and there's investor demand, and there's foreign investors. So there's actually three things, right? If you count foreign investors separate from the local investor. But, you know, nobody really needs three or four homes. And if we didn't finance those kind of acquisitions, and I remember it wasn't that long ago where it was very difficult to get a loan to buy your third or fourth property, right? Everybody didn't have too much trouble getting one loan to get a mortgage to live and occupy. Owner-occupied mortgages were much easier to get. But as soon as you started going to become an investor to get a second and third and fourth property, then the obstacles got to be pretty severe. And obviously something's changed. I don't know where these people are getting financed to buy these investment properties where they're just looking to flip the property. But that would make a big difference if we took that out of the if we took most of that out of the equation, and it might not be the lenders that end up bringing that to a halt. It might be just that house prices go down. I mean, as soon as house prices are down 20%, let's just pick a number, the investment demand disappears completely. Right? People are not that attracted to something that's going down, especially when they're borrowing so much money to try and make a quick profit. So maybe that's what needs to happen. I think affordability will be restored. It'll take a number of years. In the U.S., it took 4 years from 2006 to 2010. Prices went down 38% over those 4 years. In Canada, it'll probably take at least that long, but it can happen. And, it's unfortunately for Canada and Australia as well, is that the real estate sector is a much bigger component of the total economy in those two countries than it was in the United States in 2006 when the U.S. housing bubble burst.
Hilliard, anything else you wanted to chat about today?
No, we're watching the markets are down. The stock market is down after rising 3% on Wednesday after the Federal Reserve decision came out. It went down, well, depending on which index you're looking at, 4 to 5% the next day. So this is, I mean, I've been working at this long enough to remember when the market went down 20% in one day on October 19th, 1987. So this isn't that big, but it's very unusual to see the stock market go up 3% one day and then go down 4% the following day. I don't think it happens very often in my long memory of working at this. So this is pretty exciting stuff, and it'll be one thing to watch for in that area is that these hedge funds take these big bets. And a rise and a drop of that magnitude with the leverage that hedge funds sometimes use. Watch for a headline that shows that one of these hedge funds got into trouble over this. And I don't think many people will shed any tears for them. I don't know. I certainly won't.
Hilliard, thank you so much for chatting with us.
Thank you, Jim.
My guest has been Hilliard Macbeth, author of the second edition of the book, When the Bubble Burst, Surviving the Canadian Real Estate Crash. If you have any questions for Hilliard or anybody else on our show, you can email them to info@HowStreet.com. Our YouTube channel is Talk Digital Network. Find us on Twitter at How Street. We're also on Facebook. I'm Jim Goddard. Thank you for listening.
Comments made on HowStreet.com radio are an expression of opinion only and should not be construed in any matter whatsoever as recommendations to buy or sell any financial instrument at any time. Available online at TalkDigitalNetwork.com. HowStreet.com radio is a production of HowStreet Media Incorporated.